in fishing communities, but all the women are scattered around the territory investigating the museum or having lunch. And so if we can get a few more to show up, return here, we'll have a few minutes of that workshop. Here, we're going to have Tommy Knowles of Crescent City, who's coming up to the stage now, talk about some of the gear that he makes himself for his own use. And we're going to have Nick Toth and his granddad, Antonio Slirios of Tarpon Springs, talking about their machine shop and some of the gear they make for sponging, some of the work they do for fishermen and others who live in Tarpon Springs and in that area. They'll be with us in just a moment. Now, in any, just about any fishing community you go to, whether it's along the Atlantic or the Gulf Coast or even inland along the St. John's River, Lake Okeechobee, Crescent Lake, anywhere there are fishermen and boatmen, you're going to find also people who make gear of various kinds. And some of the people who make gear are the people who also use them. And that gear can include things like nets and traps and boats, hooks even, gaffs, parts of boats, engines, all kinds of things. And many of these things are not the type of things that you might get in a hardware shop someplace else. A lot of these things are made according to information that's traditional. That is information that's passed on in families and in communities by watching and copying or by word of mouth. Guiding people to make objects of various kinds. Now, I've invited three gentlemen to join me this afternoon for this workshop, and all three are very skilled makers of a variety of gear that relates to fishing and watermen. I'd like to introduce on my far right Tommy Knowles from Crescent City, a commercial fisherman who also makes all kinds of gear, and I'll be asking him about that in a moment. Next to him is Antonio Larios. Mr. Larios from Tarpon Springs, who is one of the most skillful machinists and probably the most senior machinist, marine machinist in the state of Florida, possibly in the country, who has knowledge of techniques and skills and designs that are possibly unique to our country. He has passed on a lot of those skills and continues to pass on a lot of those skills to his grandson, who's sitting next to me, Nick Toth of Tarpon Springs, and together they work in Mr. Larios' machine shop there. A lot of the equipment you see on the table over here, a lot of that brass and copper equipment is made by Nick and his grandfather. Has to do with the sponge diving industry of Tarpon Springs, at one time a bustling and booming trade. Since the 40s, I guess, has sort of fallen into a decline. Yet there are still people who pursue natural sponges and require specialized gear to obtain them. Mr. Larios and Nick also make parts for engines and boats, other types of metal gear for the most part that they fabricate themselves to their own designs, in many cases, in their shop. So there's a brief introduction. I'll introduce myself, too. My name is David Taylor, and I'm a folklorist, and I work for the Bureau of Florida Folklife Programs here in White Springs. We're the people who plan and coordinate and do the research that goes into the Florida Folk Festival, among other activities that we pursue throughout the year to expose the public to the important and valued traditions of the people of Florida. Now, let me ask you a question, Tommy. Can you tell first and briefly what type of fishing you do?
I do mostly trap fishing for catfish, blue crab, and eels. That two of those, the eels and the catfish, is freshwater. The blue crab is saltwater and freshwater. I can catch blue crabs off of St. John's in Lake Crescent, and that's considered fresh water. Those are the primary fishes that I go for.
And what sort of gear do you use for that?
For the catfish.
You can just take that microphone off if you want. Just screw it towards you. There you go.
For the catfish, I use a wire trap, basket some people call them, but I refer to them as a trap. It has a trap door. This device requires bait. You have to bait the catfish in order to get him to come in there. And I use a bait called soybean chips. It's actually crushed soybeans pressed together. We put 8 to 10 pounds of that in the trap, and when the trap is fishing, the bait will be right underneath there where you see it, between the throat and the bottom of the trap. The fish will feed, and if you watch that door in the middle there, the trap door, you'll see it open as the trap turns down. See him swinging? Now, when it's laying on fishing, it's fishing flat on the bottom, just like it sits here. And the fish will start feeding there, and he'll nudge that door and eventually work through that door. The door works on gravity, and it's a one-way door. Once he's in there, the only way for him to get out is if the trap turns upside down, and the only way that that can happen is if it got accidentally hooked and got rolled upside down. And you see the door flops open upside down so that any fish trapped back here can swim right back out. But if he fishes like he's supposed to, he can't get out of that trap until I take him out. And I take him out through this door right here. We have two small wire latches, and we undo those and open up the compartment there where he's trapped. And that there are several other ways to catch catfish. Trot line, that's the hardest way. That's a lot of work, a lot of hours, time-consuming job. Another way is hook nets. I don't like to fish hook nets. They're too big and cumbersome for one man to work. Usually have to have a partner, and I'm kind of a loner. I like to work alone, so that kind of restricts me to either trot lines or the fish traps. And trot lines is a last resort. I don't like to use trot lines because, like I say, it consumes a lot of time. Okay, this is an eel trap. I also catch eels. We set these, we bait these with horseshoe crabs, get horseshoe crabs and chop them up, put the bait right in here where you see the cup. Okay, the eel goes in here to get to the bait, and we put a webbing throat on the second funnel in here. There's a little piece of webbing sewn right there. You can see that little piece of webbing. All that is a tube. He can swim through that, but once he's back there, then it's difficult for him to find the opening to go back out because it closes. And that's basically how that works. And I don't know how the blue crab trap works. But anyway, this is a blue crab trap. We put the bait in here. The crab goes in through here. And for some reason that I can't answer, just theories, when the crab is feeding here on the bait and another crab enters, it spooks this crab, and his natural movement is in an upward motion. So he goes up through this slot right here in the top of this baffle. And once he's up there, for some reason or other, he doesn't find that slot to go back down. And when we take him out, this is ready to dump now. It's in an open position. But that's the way it is when it's in the fishing position. This side is closed, and when you want to take him out, unhook that, and this side opens up. This side opens up, and then just dump him out. But you also have to bait this device. This device doesn't work without bait. And outside of bait fishing, and that's catching crab bait, I also catch my own crab bait with nets. And outside of that, that's the fishing that I do. And at times, I will be working all three pieces of gear at the same time. Not in the same day, but at the same time of year, all three of these devices will be working.
What do you need to make traps like that? What are the materials and tools that you use?
Okay, with the crab trap, I use a vinyl-coated hex mesh, 1.5 inches. Are the dimensions on this. You buy it by the roll like you see on the table over here to my right. You buy it by the roll, cut it, bend it, and twist it together and hog ring it together. This probably revolutionized trap making is the hog rings. And all it is a small clip shaped like a C. You probably won't be able to see one. But that's what it is. That's called a hog ring. And there are pliers called hog ring pliers. Okay. That's what it looks like whenever you're ready to clip it on the trap. Now that's spring-loaded pliers. Okay, so they hold it in position while you're getting ready to clip it. And you can see all along here the seams are clipped with these things, hog rings. And that speeded up the trap making process. We used to have to use wires and twist wires around that. And with this you can do it pretty quick. You need a pair of pliers, and I use a small pair of pliers that I've ground the teeth off of, because you don't want to cut the vinyl. And by grinding the teeth off, you won't cut the vinyl. And of course, wire cutters. Those are the three basic tools that I use to put all these together. The fish trap, you can get the wire in vinyl coated like this. Now I know this looks like it's vinyl coated, but this is actually a product, this is dipped in a product called coal tar. And that's C-O-A-L tar. We put the coal tar in a vat and heat the tar until it becomes a thin liquid like water, and then we dip this trap in it. This preserves the life of the trap. We also periodically have to take the trap out and clean the trap up, and when we do that process, we re-dip it, so that helps prolong the life of the trap. I'm fishing some of these traps that I built 15 years ago. So by taking care of them and keeping them dipped, they do have a pretty good life. Eel trap, it's also vinyl coated wire. As you can see, the dimensions of the wire are somewhat smaller, because an eel would get through, a market size eel would go through this size wire. So you want to use a wire that would hold a market size eel.
Okay, thanks very much, Tommy.
You're
Those
welcome.
Are three pieces of gear that are very strange to my eye. And maybe to some of yours too, and that's a very good explanation of how they're used and how they're built. I'm going to return to Tommy in a minute, but I'd like Nick Toth to tell us a bit about the type of work that he and his grandfather do in their shop. Mr. Larios's first language is Greek, and he's asked Nick to respond for him in English, I believe.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I guess we're most noted for making our diving helmets. And I've been doing that now with him for about 8 years. And besides the diving helmets that you see over on the table there, we also make, for the sponge diving industry, we also make the sponge diving hooks that they use to tear the sponge off the bottom while they're harvesting them. And we make things like what we call the sponge rings, which are rings that collapse in half, and they sew nets to that. And the diver uses that to fill his bag while he's down harvesting. He fills the sponge bag up and gives it a few tugs, and the line tender will pull that up. Aside from the sponge diving industry, we make a number of things for commercial shrimp boats and fishing boats. And we work on the winches, their propellers, their shafts. We work on the diesel motors. We do just about everything to do with metal work on these commercial vessels at our shop there.
In addition to you, are there other shops that do any of the sponge industry work?
No, there are no other shops that really do that. That's sort of a lost art, being able to fabricate some of the things they use in the sponge diving itself. In other coastal communities, a few places, there are shops that do tend to the commercial shrimp boats and the fishing boats, but as far as in Tarpon Springs area, we're pretty much the only people that are doing that. You know, he's the only old timer left doing it, and consequently I'm the only one that it's been handed down to.
Right there. Right. A piece of equipment that I think your grandfather built, that I've become quite familiar with in the last couple of days, is that enormous piece of equipment with the red kind of what would you call that red piece?
A flywheel.
Flywheel. Could you tell us what that is and how it came to be developed?
That's an air compressor. That's a replica of the type of hand-cranked, hand-operated air compressor they used at the turn of the century. And he started on that about 7 or 8 years ago, piddling around in the shop, taking stock pieces of metal and just machining it on the milling machine and on the lathe, and putting together the, he made the wood patterns. You see everything there that's made out of brass. He made a wood pattern for, had it cast, and then machined it. And over the last few years, whenever he'd get a chance, he assembled that. The red wheel you see on there is about 100 years old, and that's off of old sponge presses, they call. They use huge presses to pack the sponge into crates for shipping. And they would. He also made these large sponge presses, two which have enormous gears on them, and they're real intricate pieces of machinery. You just push the wheel one time, and it'll just start spinning on its own and pressing the sponge down. But anyway, that thing right there is a replica of the ones they use at the turn of the century. And he just put it together. And up until, I guess, 9 months ago, we made the crankshaft for it. That was the last thing left to do on it, and that was about the hardest thing, so we left it for last. We got a big piece of steel, cut it out, twisted it, as you can see, then machined all the journals on it. And there you see it.
Okay, thank you. That gives us a little bit of an idea of the many types of things that Mr. Larios and Nick do in the machine shop. The machinists are a fixture in many maritime communities, and fishermen depend on them very much to keep their boats and fishing gear running properly for them. It's much cheaper to hire a machinist to fix what you have than it is to go out and buy an entire new winch or a new engine or something like that, right?
Definitely.
I'd like to talk a moment about the designs of types of gear like these traps. Tommy, how did you get the ideas for the shapes of traps like that, and how do you repeat them time and time again?
The individual usually determines his own pattern. This particular trap here, the fish trap, is a modification of the trap that my dad built years ago when he first started trap fishing. There are some changes, but the basics are the same. When he built them, he would use 5-foot wire. Well, I used 5-foot wire too, and then 5-foot wire got scarce, no longer available, and what was available was 2-foot wire, and I had to piece the 2-foot wire together. And then we got a hold of some 4-foot wire, and now 5-foot wire is available again. So you use what's available and modify from there. The basic changes that I've made has been in the catch throat, what I call a catch throat, or trap door design. When my dad built his original pattern, he used what was referred to as a heart door. And by that, simply, this catch door right here was round, and in the shape, the door that hung on it was in the shape of like a heart, if you can picture that. A round heart-shaped trap door here. I had trouble using the heart door, so he also made a rectangle door similar to this, and I tried using it, and I liked it better than I liked the heart door. But I had a problem. As you can see, the door itself is a rectangle shape, kind of. And the frame would be the same. In other words, the frame went off to the same point here and across. And I would have trouble with my door getting cockeyed inside of the frame and hanging up. So I come up with the idea that if I could bring those corners in and angle them off, it would keep this trap door from getting hung up. And once that trap door hung up, why, no fish would go on in there. So I just cut the corners off and reshape the frame around the trap door. And that served the purpose, works good, and so I stuck with that design. And the way I repeat it is I have a pattern. I take each individual piece of wire, and as the wire comes off the roll, it's round, I cut it to length, then I take a hammer on a block of wood and straighten the wire, and take a pair of pliers and bend the wire between my thumb and finger, just bend the wire to pattern after this frame, and I repeat the same pattern over and over.
How many different patterns would you use for that type of trap? Just for that rectangle or others?
Other fish traps?
For other parts of that particular trap, how many types of patterns might you use?
Okay, you can use there is a different throat here. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, I'm wondering about templates and other patterns that help you get the shape of parts of your trap.
Yeah, everything. I have a pattern for everything. In other words, the hooks that you see, the heavier wire around the trap, I have a length. I have a pattern that I cut that by. The frame around the dump door here, I have a frame for that. Each individual piece, I have a template for, and I bend everything and measure everything to that template.
Mm-hmm.
Each trap is individual, but each part of the trap is made from the same basic piece of material.
Right.
This piece right here usually varies most in design is the doorstop itself. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I'll build it narrow, sometimes wide, and that's for my own identification purposes.
Right. If we had 100 fish traps in here built by men who fish in your fishing area, could you pick out your own?
Yeah.
What would you look at?
This design right here. No one else does this frame design except me.
Mm-hmm.
That would be the obvious that I would look for. Then there would be other small things that I would look for. Like I was telling you, the doorstop is put on in a certain manner. The door itself, there are certain things on there that I could look at and tell that that's my door.
Okay.
Just like your child, you would, if he was standing off out there and 100 kids, yeah, that's my child, right, John? I produced that child.
Okay, thank you, Tommy.
You're welcome.
Now, talking about patterns and jigs, templates, physical objects that help maintain a design, I'll put that question to Nick as well. Do you use things like that in your shop?
Yes, we use quite a few templates and jigs for just about everything. We use everything from making my portholes, like I said, for the helmets. Everything, we've made a wood pattern for everything that you see that's brass, and we have it cast, use that to have it cast whenever we're going to make a helmet. And from that we machine our parts. Besides the portholes and all the air fittings and the valves and whatnot on the helmet that are made from wood patterns, I have a number of things I use that could be an object as simple as a piece of pipe that has a certain diameter that I'll use over and over again for a particular job. I have a 3.5-inch piece of pipe I have at my shop about 6 inches long. I stick in my vise, and I use that to make my sponge hooks, as you'll see on the table, a curved hook. And I take it and I bend it over that pipe. I heat it and bend it over that and forge it that way. I have other patterns, just plates of steel with steel pegs sticking out of it that I use for my rings to make a round, to bend my steel into a round hoop, and things of that nature.
It's, mm-hmm. It's basically to save time in the process?
Yeah, to save time. If it's something you know you'll be repeating, you'll be doing a job over again, you'll go ahead and make one. And some jobs you have to make one, even if you don't know you're going to do that job ever again, but sometimes it requires a pattern to do your work. Mm-hmm. And we'll save that pattern, and who knows, I've had, you know, years later, something will come up, and you'll remember what corner of the shop the piece of steel is laying in, and you'll use it. I have a whole corner of my shop that has looks just to be cut up pieces of junk and steel laying there, but everything's for a purpose, and you can't dare throw anything away because they are things I use for my work, and consequently it looks like you're collecting junk in the corner there.
Do you have paper plans or patterns too?
I rarely use sometimes I'll make a template to match a bolt pattern. I'll do that out of a heavy cardboard if I'm going to produce something. But I'll usually go ahead and make the template out of a piece of steel, trace my pattern on a piece of steel and cut that out and use that as the pattern. But I do on occasion use a heavy cardboard where I'll tap out the shape of the object I'm trying to match the pattern to.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we've got a few more minutes left here. I was wondering if anyone else has a question besides me, of these three fellows, about making gear. Right. What's the most catfish that Tommy's caught one of those traps at one time?
Out of this design, probably the most that I've caught out of this would be 100 pounds. Well, if if he weighed a pound apiece, that'd be 100 fish. But the average size of a fish that would go in this device is about a half pound fish, half pound to a pound. Yeah. Yeah, they can pack in there. However, if you were looking at this thing like this, that sounded good, I'll bet. Okay, if you were looking at this in this position with fish in this trap, at this ring right here on down, that would hold approximately 100 pounds of fish. Now, I had a trap one time, and so many fish went in that one trap that they suffocated themselves. And when I went back to raise that trap, now the particular trap I'm talking about was a 5-foot trap, and it had so many fish that had packed themselves in there that they had suffocated themselves, and it took my brother and myself to dump that trap, and there was about 200 pounds of fish in that trap. And that is the absolute most that I've ever had in one trap. But an average catch for a device like this based on a 4-day catch would be about 15 pounds of dressed fish. That would be considered a fairly good catch.
Any other questions? Okay, we're just about out of time. I'd just like to say again that in talking about gear, there are a lot of regional differences. Gear like Tommy's, you're probably not likely to see in coastal communities because those species that he pursues in his local conditions are not found elsewhere. And that knowledge is probably likely to stay mainly centered in Tommy's region. Just like Nick and his grandfather, the knowledge of making diving helmets and sponging gear will probably stay specific to the regions where sponges are caught. But in any maritime community, you're likely to find gear makers, whether they be like Tommy, the fellow who's also going to use it and is modifying a design that's been passed down to him, sort of standing on the shoulders of those who have come before him, like he's told us about modifying his dad's design, or like Mr. Larios and Nick Toth, who are specialists who perform services for other people in their community. Pay attention to these as you go around and see the importance of what a folklorist like me would call the material culture, or the objects that are made in a traditional way in maritime communities everywhere. So I'd like to thank Tommy Knowles and Antonios Lirios and Nick Toth for sharing their knowledge with us this afternoon. Let's give them a round of applause. Okay, in just a couple of minutes, the Junkanoos from Key West will be with us, be setting up to play some great island music for us all. Stick